From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Just yesterday, I heard a colleague of mine say, "The stakes feel so much higher now when I wash my hands." Does it feel that way to you? Has there been a run on hand sanitizer where you are? Do people give you a worried side eye when you cough, even just a little? Are you trying really, really hard not to touch your own face? Now look, coronavirus is a serious global issue, but the real question we want to ask today is, should people be afraid? I mean, global markets seem extremely panicky, and we really want to understand why. So let's try to get the balance right between prudence and panic. So this hour on Point, the worldwide coronavirus epidemic and what we should be doing about it in our own daily lives. And we have a terrific expert here to help us out today. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's an internist, infectious diseases specialist, and an epidemiologist as well. She's also host of the two podcasts, Epidemic and American Diagnosis. You'll find a link to those podcasts at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Gounder, welcome to On Point.
My pleasure.
I should also say that in 2015, you volunteered as a medical worker in Guinea during the Ebola outbreak there, so you have real frontline experience for serious epidemics.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, what we really want to do today is kind of break through the all caps, all exclamation point journalism that can happen around major medical issues like this and give people some useful information. So let me just start off with the basics.
Sure.
Should people in the United States be afraid of coronavirus?
So, you know, I think, great question. I think we should be concerned. I think we should be cautious and take precautions to protect ourselves. I don't think we should be afraid. You know, I think when you let fear take over, I don't think it's really the appropriate emotion to have in response to this right now. But secondly, it leads to really poor decision making. And it can lead to everything from unscientific policies that actually lead to more transmission to stigmatizing people and harming people in that way.
So we just heard this just yesterday, I believe, or this week, for example, Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York saying, "I get the emotion. I understand it." Cuomo said, "I'm a native-born New Yorker. We live with anxiety, but the facts don't back it up here." Is he right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, we're still waiting to get all of the data on, you know, people keep asking me, what's the prevalence? What's the case fatality rate? And those numbers are shifting because we're getting more, better, more complete data. We're getting data from different places. So, you know, the data from South Korea and Italy, for example, may be a little bit more applicable to our setting than what was happening in Wuhan or Iran. So, you know, I think big picture, this is probably going to be somewhere less severe than something like, you know, the 2% case fatality rate that you saw with 1918 Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. But it'll be more severe than the seasonal flu. It'll be somewhere in between. And again, you know, the key populations who have to worry are people who are elderly, especially in their 70s and 80s, people with chronic medical diseases, and healthcare workers, because they're going to be caring for those patients. Mm.
Well, we are talking this hour with Dr. Celine Gounder. As I mentioned, she's an internist and an infectious diseases specialist and an epidemiologist as well. And, you know, folks, quite frankly, we thought it would be just helpful to kind of have an Ask the Doctor hour because there is so much almost hyperventilation going on, definitely online and in the media about coronavirus. We're getting some calm, sober, factual advice today. Dr. Gounder, it tells us a lot about the world we live in where Ask the Doctor hours are actually good journalism these days. But let's actually go straight to one of our callers. Yeah. Let's go to Norris, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Norris, you're on the air.
Hello, all. This is Norris Dale. I'm in Portland, Maine, and I'm a retired quality assurance engineer. My question is regarding false positives and false negatives with all the discussion of the testing that's taking place. I'm curious about, first of all, what the false positive and negative rates are for the tests, and secondly, what the consequences of those false test results is. Mm-hmm. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
So a false positive, just to sort of explain those terms, false positive means you're test positive, but you don't actually have the coronavirus or whatever illness it is. False negative means you have the disease, but your test comes back negative. So let's break it down. False positive, you know, what would happen? Well, you could be hospitalized, you could be isolated, you could be quarantined, even if you did not have the disease. You know, and so obviously that's a hassle if you don't have the disease, if you're not able to be with your family, go to work. And potentially, if you're quarantined with other people who may have the disease, you could be infected by being around people who are infected when you're not. So that's the issue with false positives. False negatives means, again, that you have the disease, but you test negative. And that's concerning, really, in terms of potential spread to others. So you may test negative. You may think you're perfectly fine to go back to work, maybe as a healthcare provider, and you end up infecting people that way. Mm. Do we have very good stats on exactly our false positive and false negative rates? Again, that, you know, those kinds of numbers we really refine on the basis of testing many people and having collateral information. So I would be remiss to give you exact numbers on that.
So I think one of the issues or questions is, so far, did we miss an opportunity to get better data with testing early on in the United States about coronavirus? I mean, I'm looking at a New York Times headline from today saying now close to a million in the U.S. could be tested for coronavirus this week because they're loosening regulations on who should be tested. Should we have done that earlier?
Yeah. I mean, there's two sets of issues there. There's the test itself, which there were problems with. You may have heard, you know, CDC was developing its own test kit, and that test kit was done with three separate steps. Two were actually testing for the coronavirus. The third was a control. So, to make sure the test was working when you performed it. And the control part of it was actually the piece that wasn't working. And so then the CDC basically did a recall and said, you know, what we sent out to the states and local health departments, you actually can't use. As of this weekend, the United States had performed less than 500 tests nationwide. South Korea had performed some 65,000. You know, so that's a huge difference in volume of testing. And we're a much bigger country, right? So the testing is definitely a problem. The FDA has made it easier for local and state health departments to develop their own tests now, academic medical centers as well, private labs as well. And so New York State, for example, now has their own test, and that's going to make a big difference. It's also a question of volume. You know, how many tests can you perform today? Mm. Can you meet the need? And then finally, sort of what are the criteria that would trigger being tested was very restrictive in the beginning. It really was dependent on travel to Wuhan or China and having very specific symptoms, lower respiratory tract symptoms, so really pneumonia symptoms. And what we're learning now is that, you know, you can have milder upper respiratory symptoms. We've seen the virus in the upper respiratory tract. So that's more of what you think about with coughs and colds. And then some people just have no symptoms at all. So I think, you know, if we really want to be capturing a better sense of how much transmission has already occurred, we really do need to be less stringent.
Okay. So it seems to me that as more people get tested, it's very probable that the infection, the prevalence of coronavirus will go up in the United States.
Right. And remember, we actually saw as they were adjusting case definitions in China, you would see the numbers spike up.
Like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And some of that was just on the basis of the definition. So if you see a big spike in cases in the U.S., all of a sudden, that may not necessarily represent recent transmission. That might be transmission that's been happening all along, and we're finally picking it up.
I see. Because it seems to me one of the reasons why it feels like people are very much on edge about coronavirus is, A, because of exactly what you said. There was this news kind of coming out of China that every day there were thousands of more people infected. It made coronavirus seem like an extremely virulent, extremely dangerous infection. And then, of course, we saw it as it was spreading. Our knowledge of where it was around the world was growing. It all happened very suddenly and very intensely. Just fact check us on this. Is that actually kind of the normal spread of a disease like this? And it just feels more intense now because of sort of the flow of information that we have globally.
I mean, I think flow of information, flow of people,
Okay.
You know, is also a huge factor here. You know, I do think it's important to note that the Chinese context is different. There are some things that they have that are really going for them. They have very strong basic laboratory scientists, basic science research. Their scientists are world class in that respect. But, you know, their hospital systems, they are not always as good about infection control, for example, as we are. And, you know, there are also other factors that could make this disease more severe in China. Smoking rates, especially among men, are much higher. And so you take a smoker, heavy smoker, who's then infected with a virus, their outcomes are going to be different from ours.
Mm. Now, when we, you know, you said earlier that there are many people who may be asymptomatic if they have coronavirus, which makes me think that it's in communities and we don't know it, right? Is that possible?
Yeah, certainly. And this has also been a bad flu year. There's been lower effectiveness with the flu vaccine this year than actually most years. So we've definitely seen more flu cases in the hospital. And so it can sort of be hiding, you know, in those numbers, because we don't always test every single person who comes in with cough, cold, flu symptoms, pneumonia symptoms. Not everybody gets all the testing. So certainly in that mix, there could be already coronavirus in there.
Yeah, I suppose it's always been good advice then, if you start to feel a little sick, coronavirus or not, to stay home if you can, right? But, you know, we're hearing like self-quarantine for 14 days. Is that reasonable? Too long? What do you think?
I mean, I think it really depends on the situation. You know, if you work from home anyway, it's probably not that hard to do. But if you have other responsibilities outside the home and your risk is low for coronavirus, you know, I think these things really need to be taken on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. I feel like that's the answer for most medical questions.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So this hour, we are talking with Dr. Celine Gounder. She's an internist, an infectious diseases specialist, and an epidemiologist. She's also host of Epidemic and American Diagnosis. They're two terrific podcasts. And we're getting some factual and sober advice from her on really what to think and how to be prepared for coronavirus. As I said, we're trying to cut through all that exclamation point journalism. We'll take a lot more of your questions for her when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking with Dr. Celine Gounder this hour, getting some sober and factual advice from her on what to think and what to do individually about coronavirus. She's an internist, infectious diseases specialist, and an epidemiologist, also host of two podcasts, Epidemic and American Diagnosis. And she also has some direct frontline experience dealing with epidemics. In 2015, she volunteered as an Ebola medical worker in Guinea. So let's go right back to our very full phone lines, Dr. Gounder. Jeff is calling from Warren, Michigan. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
So I'm actually going to be traveling from Detroit on a plane tomorrow on Wednesday to Kansas, neither one necessarily being where cases of corona are reported, but I get nervous going to an airport. My wife is in the health services field, so she was able to secure a mask for me. I just need to know, is it really necessary, beneficial if I'm on a plane? Do I wear the mask? Am I Clorox wiping the entire seat tray around me? What's recommended? What do we really think I need to do or not do if I'm traveling on a plane tomorrow?
Jeff, I'm sure many people have that exact question, so thank you for asking it. Dr. Gounder?
So, Jeff, you know, and thank you for mentioning where you were traveling from and to, because that really does help answer the question. So in your specific case, you know, I think it's completely reasonable to travel. Some of the things I would say about the masks, so there's two different kinds of masks. You have the surgical masks, which are really meant to be put on people with symptoms. So the idea being that they trap the droplets that you spray when you cough, when you sneeze, when you talk, they're actually trapping those droplets inside the mask so that they're not getting into the general atmosphere around you. So there's that kind of mask. So if you're sick, yeah, you should wear those. And then if you are a healthcare worker or having, you know, somebody who's having close contact caring for somebody, then you would wear what's called an N95 mask. You know, maybe your wife would wear one at work because she's caring for patients. But there's really no indication to wear one of those if you're just trying to protect yourself against routine, you know, contact with people. You have to remember, like, if I go see a patient in the emergency room, that person may have soiled themselves. They may be coughing up sputum or blood. They may, you know, I'm listening to their heart and lungs, getting very close to them. Remember Dr. Li, the ophthalmologist who died in China? Think about how an ophthalmologist examines your eyes. They're literally right up in your face. So that's a very different level of exposure.
Dr. Gounder, let me just jump in here, though. I mean, he said, should he be wearing the mask? And you said, if you're sick, but it didn't sound like Jeff was sick. And yet we're seeing, like, all of these reports of masks being totally sold out in places across the country to the point where healthcare workers are having difficulty getting them. Are people, I mean, it sounds like they should not be stockpiling masks if they're healthy.
Right. And you have one thing to understand is if you make it difficult for healthcare workers to do their job, if they do not feel like they can go to work and be safe in doing their job, you might see nurses striking. You might see people not showing up for work. And that's going to be disruptive for everybody's care. So you come in with a stroke. You know, we talk about time from the time that you come in through the door to the time where you get medical attention, because that stroke could be a lot worse if you're not attended too quickly. So, you know, having people on the job feeling like it's safe is really important.
So also I'm curious about sort of the social effects of wearing a mask, especially on a place like an airplane, which is a utterly confined environment. And maybe actually your experience working on Ebola might be really informative here, because I could imagine, like, if you got on board an airplane, and even if you're healthy and you wear a mask, I mean, the people sitting next to you, they may not want to sit next to you. They might say, we don't want this person on the airplane. Is there a risk of sort of like panic setting in simply because someone tries to do the right thing?
Right. Well, I think some of that is cultural. Okay. So if you go someplace in like China or India, a lot of people wear masks routinely because of the pollution, right? And so depending, and actually they are more accustomed to wearing masks to prevent transmission of disease if they have symptoms. So they are more used to those practices. Whereas here, if you were to wear a mask on a plane or at the office, you know, I heard about somebody at one of the offices a friend of mine works at, and everybody was afraid that this person came into work wearing a mask. So I think, you know, it really can create a lot of fear.
Okay. And Jeff also asked about Clorox wiping down the seats.
You know, it's not going to do any harm. If it makes you feel better, I'm sure the airlines will be super happy that you're helping with their maintenance, you know, and probably the tray table is the most, if you're going to wipe down anything, it's the tray table. Just make sure if you're going to do all of that, that you use Purell or some other alcohol-based hand sanitizer afterwards, because you may actually get all kinds of stuff
hands.
On your hands. Yeah.
But like, is wiping it down effective? Like if there were coronavirus?
Yeah.
It is. Okay. And one more thing. He mentioned where he was going, which was important. Say you're traveling to Washington State now, where we've had all thus far the coronavirus deaths in the U.S. Is that, would you counsel against that?
You know, I think you have to, so I divide this into, are you traveling domestically or are you traveling foreign? If domestically, to a place that's been affected, similarly with the foreign travel, are you somebody who's at risk of getting infected? So are you somebody who's elderly? Are you somebody with chronic medical conditions? And then, you know, in terms of foreign travel, I think there's some added factors here. So let's say you get sick. How do you feel about the local medical care? So getting sick and being in Singapore is very different from getting sick and, I don't know, being in rural Italy or, you know, being in Cambodia, for example. So, you know, I think that really does matter. And then finally, and you know, I think unfortunately, I personally fear traveling overseas because I'm worried that some of the travel restrictions that evolve may not be scientifically based.
Meaning what?
Well, meaning I could be stuck somewhere because the U.S. decides to implement some travel restriction for non-scientific reasons. That's actually what I personally worry the most about in traveling overseas.
I see.
Because we've seen irrational things happen before. You remember Casey Hickox, you know, at Newark Airport, the nurse who came back was quarantined in a parking lot, you know, outside of Newark Airport, basically given a porta potty and was stuck there, you know, duking it out with Chris Christie at the time. So I think, you know, that makes me nervous.
So you're worried about the policy overreactions that may not be based in science. Interesting. Mm-hmm. OK, let's go back to our callers. Chris is calling from Decatur, Illinois. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question a lot like the last caller. My wife and I are scheduled to fly out to Las Vegas next week for a wedding. And we're flying out of Chicago to Las Vegas, staying at, you know, one of the big casinos. And we're both healthy in our mid-40s. We do have young children and we're just concerned that there's been a lot of business travel stopped, and you know, should we be taking a trip that's just for pleasure?
Yeah, Chris, great question, because we've been hearing about conferences being canceled, all sorts of things. I mean, obviously, Las Vegas is a place with lots of crowds. Mm-hmm. Should Chris be avoiding places where he's going to be in a room with hundreds of other people?
Well, I think one of the questions he raised is also children, right? So in terms of children, we have not seen severe infections or deaths in children. Children actually seem to do very well with this. They may not have any symptoms at all. So if what you're worried about is, am I going to bring something home to my kids? That's really not what I would be concerned about. You know, and then going back to what I was saying earlier, this is domestic travel from and to places that have not really been affected to our knowledge yet. Now, that could evolve in the next few days, so keep that in mind. You know, the other piece of it that I didn't mention earlier that I would think about is, could you potentially be spreading this elsewhere? So could you be somebody who picks it up, has an asymptomatic or few symptoms, and then you bring it back to your community?
How would you know, though?
You may not know. You know, and again, this is sort of, it's hard. I can't tell you what to do in this situation, right? You know, but personally, would I travel to Kirkland, Washington right now? Probably not. And, you know, I wouldn't be so worried for myself, but I wouldn't be so excited to be bringing it back to New York City.
Right.
You know, and part of the reason we're seeing these diseases spread more now is because we do travel so much more and we mix together so much more.
So speaking of kids, on the other end of things, we have a question coming in on Facebook. Nate saying, we keep hearing that people with chronic diseases are more at risk. Do we know about which type of chronic diseases may put people more at risk?
Well, I mean, we have a pretty good sense in that it's similar for other infectious diseases like the flu. So anybody who has heart or lung disease, so if you, for example, have emphysema, you're certainly at higher risk. Diabetes, we know weakens the immune system, so certainly that. Patients who are on dialysis tend to have weaker immune systems. If you're on drugs for an autoimmune disease like lupus, you know, those kinds of things. Or if you've had a transplant. I have a friend who's had two liver transplants even before the age of 18 because she had a congenital liver disease and she's on a ton of immunosuppression. You know, she is somebody who needs to worry.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Alice, who's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Alice, you're on the air. What's your question for Dr. Gounder?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about hand sanitizer. So hand sanitizer usually says that kills 99% of bacteria, but this is a virus. So should we really be stocking up on hand sanitizer, or should we just be really diligent about washing our hands, which I would assume is better for getting rid of viruses?
Purell may want you to stock up on it, but Dr. Gounder, should we?
Actually, I'd say they're pretty equivalent for most things. The one thing that I do not recommend Purell or any other alcohol hand sanitizer for is C. diff. In full, it's C. difficile diarrhea or colitis that you're talking about, because that's a bacteria, actually, that has creates spores which can germinate in your gut. And so that is not eliminated by an alcohol hand sanitizer. You really do need to wash with soap and water. But for most things, if you don't have like visible body fluid on your hands or whatever the surface is, an alcohol hand sanitizer is fine. A lot of it really comes down more to technique. So making sure you're hitting all the surfaces on your hands, you know, say between the thumb and index finger, but, you know, between all the fingers, the base of your hand, the back of your hand, under your nails, you know, that the technique and the duration is really what's important.
I want to ask about the advice that I've been seeing, I have to say, largely on social media, so a little asterisk there, about people, even if they're not sick, as long as coronavirus is an issue, to not touch their faces. I mean, that's a real behavioral change, which, is it effective? Is it important? Should people be trying to control their behavior to that extent?
I mean, I think that's good advice, period.
I'm doomed then. I'm seriously. I say it's funny, but like seriously, like it's a really it's an unconscious behavior that we all do.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it is how we end up with the common cold as well. And, you know, and the flu. And so, you know, I think it's not a bad thing to try to break out of that habit. I think this is an opportunity for us to reevaluate other just cultural behaviors like shaking hands. You know, that's probably not the most sanitary thing to be doing, especially when we know people, when they go to the bathroom, it's like 60 to 70% of people wash their hands. So that means 30 to 40% don't. Right? And so, you know, I think it might be a good thing to sort of reevaluate some of these things.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Mark is calling from New Orleans. Mark, you're on the air. Okay, Mark, if we'll try to get you back. Let's go to Rubina, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Rubina, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question was that it seems like there are a couple of subtypes of coronavirus. And one of my friends, she's a pulmonologist working at an ICU in upstate New York. She was telling me yesterday or the day before, she treated a lot of patients. They were tested for a coronavirus positive. They called the CDC, apparently, and the CDC told them that they didn't meet criteria to verify that this was the coronavirus that, you know, people are looking for. So they didn't recommend that these people be tested because they didn't come in contact with anybody traveling. So my question to you, you know, why would the CDC do that? Because there have been some cases, from my understanding, that there was no traveling involved.
Mm. Rubina, thank you for your question. Dr. Gounder?
I mean, I would really need to see some of the more specific details of those patients to know for sure the answer to your question. But in general, so coronaviruses, it's a broader category. So it's sort of like saying primates. You have humans, you have chimpanzees, you have gorillas, you have a number of different kinds of primates. So similarly, coronaviruses, there are many coronaviruses, some of which cause the common cold. SARS was a coronavirus. MERS was a coronavirus. And COVID-19, also known as SARS-CoV-2, which is a mouthful, that is the novel coronavirus. So I'm not sure exactly what they tested for and what they tested positive for. So it's a little hard to answer that one.
How long is this likely to last? I mean, how long are we going to have to be vigilant about this particular coronavirus?
I don't know the answer to that, honestly. I mean, it's going to probably slow down a bit over the summer months, and then you'll have back to school in the fall. Things will get cooler again. People will be indoors more together again, so it'll probably pick up again, kind of like what you see normally with the cough, cold, flu season.
It could end up being just kind of another endemic.
It could, yeah. Yeah,
disease.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and if that happens, I would predict the vaccine for coronavirus might be co-formulated with our, you know, seasonal flu vaccine, depending on, you know, exactly the details of how the vaccine ends up being made. So, you know, that's certainly possible.
I'm curious, have you made any changes in your life in the past couple of weeks or month in response to coronavirus spreading?
Wow, good question. I mean, I don't know. We have Purell at home anyway. Like, I walk in the door, the first thing I do is Purell. I train my husband to do the same thing. You know, I have always been a cough in your elbow, not in your hands person. I mean, I guess I'm not shaking hands, but that's probably the only thing I've really changed.
So no 2-week stockpile of supplies in case you have to self-quarantine?
I haven't. And honestly, you know, I know some parts of the country are seeing empty shelves. At least where I live in New York City, I haven't seen that yet. So I don't know. I'm not so worried about that.
Okay. And I also, I'm curious, how should parents or family members talk to their kids about this? Because, I mean, asking for a little person that I know, she's actually quite on edge because it's so much in the news all the time and friends are talking about it at school. Do you have any advice on that?
I think I'd focus on the hand washing. Okay. And also just say, look, this isn't about, you know, kids. This is about grandma, grandpa, and we want to keep them safe. And how can we care for them by washing our hands? I think that's where I would put the focus with kids.
Okay. And in the last minute that we have, you've answered all of our questions, which I presume are only the tip of the iceberg of the questions people want to ask you. But given your professional background and also your experience with Ebola, just quickly tell me, how do you think the U.S. response has been thus far?
I think it's been disorganized. Okay. I think there has not been clear leadership from the top. And part of that is there's not a clear one person in charge. You know, I think that was what was really smart with the Ebola response was choosing an Ebola czar, somebody who could sort of cross the different departments, so Department of Health, National Security, Department of Defense, and really be able to bridge those. And we still have a lot of confusion about who's in charge.
Sounds like overall your message, though, is to be prepared, be prudent, but don't panic.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Celine Gounder, she's an internist, infectious diseases specialist, and an epidemiologist as well, and host of Epidemic and American Diagnosis. They're two terrific podcasts. We have a link to them at onpointradio.org. Dr. Gounder, thank you so much. We might invite you back again if this thing keeps going.
Okay? My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll take a look at coronavirus's effect on global markets. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk a little bit now about the effect that the spread of coronavirus is having on global markets. Just today, members of the G7 group of nations put out a statement saying, quote, given the political impacts of novel coronavirus or COVID-19 on global growth, we reaffirm our commitment to use all appropriate policy tools to achieve strong, sustainable growth and safeguard against downside risks. Well, how did the markets react to that? For an answer, let's turn to Gillian Tett. She's chair of the editorial board and U.S. editor at large for the Financial Times. Gillian joins us from New York. Gillian, welcome to On Point.
Well, it's great to be on the show.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about how the world markets so far have been reacting over the past couple of days to this increased talk from national leaders about providing some kinds of financial supports to prop up the world economy. What's been going on?
Well, what we've seen the last few days is that it's not just viruses that can jump around the world at a scary speed. It's also panic. And the markets have shown an extraordinary amount of jitters. In fact, they've been on a rollercoaster ride as different types of information has come out. During last week, they fell very sharply as investors really started to worry about the economic impact of the virus. And that was reinforced by predictions from groups like the OECD in Paris that came out and said that essentially it expected growth to be severely undermined this year as a result of the virus. But then we had this statement from the IMF, World Bank and the G7, which tried to reassure investors. And we've now had the Federal Reserve do something quite extraordinary that we've not seen since the financial crisis, which is to make an emergency cut of rates. They've cut interest rates by 50 basis points. Now, what's happened is that the markets have reacted with some relief to all this scramble by the governments around the world. But there's always a danger, as we saw during the 2008 and 2009 crisis, that when governments start to do emergency measures, investors start to ask, well, maybe they know something I don't, right. And it's even worse than I actually realized.
So let's talk about that Fed rate cut, that half a point rate cut today, which is a lot, right? The Fed says in a statement, quote, the coronavirus poses evolving risks to economic activity. In light of these risks and in support of achieving its maximum employment and price stability goals, the Federal Open Market Committee today decided to lower that target rate for the federal funds rate. I mean, how significant is it that this is the biggest rate cut since we saw in the financial crisis in 2008? I mean, the question that you were raising, do they know something about the vulnerability of even just the U.S. economy that the rest of us don't?
Well, it is an absolutely extraordinary move, and it's doubly extraordinary if you are brutal and heartless and look at how many people have actually died on American soil from this virus so far. And it's tragic, but it's not that high yet. So obviously, this is going to leave people worried about whether there's something out there that investors don't know about, but which the government does. What is becoming clear is that it's not so much the virus which is really threatening the economy, it's the emergency measures that governments are implementing to combat it, like shutting down schools or essentially shutting down ports or even at some point maybe the aviation systems cross-border. That's what's really creating the real economic damage. And so it may be the case that the Fed has looked at this situation and said, we expect the American government to implement a series of emergency measures in the coming weeks, and that's why we're acting now, because we can see that the impact is going to be big on the economy. Alternatively, though, there's another school of thought that says actually what's happening is that Trump or the White House is essentially bullying the Fed to do everything they possibly can to keep the economy afloat in an election year. And this is almost a kind of insurance cut to make sure that we don't get any market panic. But the issue is this, playing with investor psychology at this time is potentially very risky. The Fed and the G7 has no choice but to try and shore up sentiment in the markets among the public. But as ever, there's a danger that by simply rushing to act, they could end up creating more jitters and actually removing them.
Right. And there's also this sort of larger, I suppose, philosophical question is perhaps a temporary slowdown in economic growth or even the world economy. Is that a reasonable price to pay to protect the public health of 7 billion humans on planet Earth?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that the US has just had 10 years of growth nonstop, which is a remarkably long run by the standards of history. And in a sense, people have almost forgotten what a recession or slowdown looks like and are terrified of experiencing it. And the other point to make is that in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis, the system got hooked on lots and lots of cheap debt right. from the private sector. That then ended and central banks jumped in. And now the system is hooked on lots of cheap public sector debt and also lots of support from central banks. And what some people in the markets are asking is that if the Fed is using all of its bullets now to try and stave off a panic, what will it have left in its arsenal if something really unexpected happens or it gets even worse?
Right. I think that's an excellent point, right? Because the Fed could keep cutting, right? It could keep making borrowing ultra cheap, but that doesn't really do anything. It does nothing to actually stop the spread of the virus, to be sure that productivity stays high, that we don't have so many workers staying home, or that, as you're saying, supply chains, so many of which originate in China, don't get disrupted. That there are myriad ways in which a global pandemic can continue to disrupt the global economy that the Fed can do nothing about.
Well, typically speaking, economists think that when the Fed cuts rates, that helps the economy in two ways. It makes borrowing cheaper, and that's supposed to spur consumers and companies to go out and invest and spend money. But that's not going to happen if everyone's panicked about the future in relation to coronavirus. But obviously, also, a Fed cut boosts asset prices and boosts equities. And that is happening now. And that's kind of reassuring because people who go home at the end of the day and look at their 401k can say, oh, it's not as bad as I feared. And that just helps to dampen down the overall level of panic. But the critical point to realize is this. 10-year Treasury rates are hovering at almost below 1%. They're at record lows. We haven't seen anything like this before in the lifetime of most of your listeners. And if the Fed keeps cutting and if concerns about recession keep growing, the really big question now is, are 10-year rates going to go negative? If so, what will that do to the system? And what will ordinary American voters and consumers feel like as the financial system goes into Alice in Wonderland? Because a world of negative rates in many ways is Alice in Wonderland. And you can look at Europe and Japan and see that having negative rates doesn't necessarily deliver growth.
How close are we to going down the rabbit hole?
Well, we've seen quite a sharp slide in the market rates in the last week. And so I imagine it's certainly entering the realm of possibility.
Wow.
Well, the Federal Reserve has always said it won't actually run a negative rate policy. So if it keeps cutting rates down to zero, it's always said it won't go negative. But there again, many of the presumptions we had about the way that finance worked have been ripped up in the last decade. Never say never, as many people are starting to say.
So, Jillian, let's talk a little bit more for a moment about the volatility that we've been seeing in, stock markets around the world. People watching that the S&P or the Dow or the NASDAQ or the FTSE, you name the global market, it's been up and down, well, mostly down, but now clawing back a little bit over the past several weeks. Now, it should be noted that, like, a market index is not equivalent to the economy as people live it and experience it. But I wonder, is there something fundamental about the global economy and, for example, China's central place in it that coronavirus is exposing? Are there weaknesses here that we need to be paying more attention to that coronavirus is actually helping us focus on?
Well, there are three things that the coronavirus has shown us. Firstly, that the footprint of China in the global economy is big and expanding fast, and much bigger than it was during any of the crises that the world has had to cope with recently. So if China sneezes, the rest of the world is going to catch cold. And that's something new we need to recognize. Secondly, we've realized that the amazing global supply chains that big companies have built to make their systems ultra efficient are potentially very vulnerable. And we haven't really been forced to confront the implications of that. We saw it a bit with the US-China trade spat, but we haven't really seen a situation where supply chain vulnerabilities come to the fore. And again, that needs more debate. But the third point we've realized is that so much of the growth and the upbeat investor sentiment in the last few years has been driven by central banks keeping money ultra cheap. And the fact it's taken the Fed rate cut to really push markets back up again shows that if at any point investors start to lose faith in the ability of central banks to keep investor optimism there, then we could be heading for new and dangerous territory.
Well, you know, about your point, your second point there about supply chains, I've been seeing that, for example, Apple CEO Tim Cook is taking a lot of heat for putting most of Apple's manufacturing in China and the potential disruptions for, you know, one of the world's largest companies now because of that. I mean, is that some of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason why we've had so many cheap consumer goods and why corporate profits for American companies have been sky high is precisely because they built these incredibly intricate supply chains that span the world and which operate with just-in-time shipping and all the brilliant efficiencies that you can create when you have a bunch of engineers creating systems. But the problem is that just as in the financial crisis of 2008, the world was suddenly forced to wake up and realize that we had these interconnections spanning the globe that no one really understood and which tended to be concentrated on a few nodes that became very vulnerable if they broke down. So too, the global supply chain systems are concentrated on a few nodes that can break down. So if a few ports stop working, if a few factories go down, then suddenly the entire system seizes up. And that's been one of the big risks that has been bubbling throughout the US-China trade war. But it's come back into the fore again now.
Mm.
You can't just take all this production and suddenly ship it to America. I mean, just to give one small example, an astonishingly large proportion of the world's semiconductors are currently coming from Taiwan. Now, Taiwan has not been impacted so badly by the virus thus far. But, you know, if that node was to suddenly break, there'd be all kinds of knock-on implications and domino effects that would be very nasty for the global economy. So that may be one reason, again, why the Fed is acting now, because it can see the fragility of these supply chains and the potential domino effect.
And they're across industries. I'm seeing here that pharmaceutical companies are warning that there could be potential shortages of medicines because some of their supply chains could be interrupted by coronavirus as well. So can we point to any sector that isn't vulnerable now?
Well, at the moment, probably, you know, domestic localized production is probably more protected. You know, there's been a theory amongst economists for a while that actually we're moving from an era of mass globalization, which was really the late 20th century and early 21st century, towards a new era, which is more focused on localization, not globalization. Yeah. History always moves in pendulum cycles, and maybe that pendulum has shifted. That shift towards localization was already on the table with the trade war discussion, the rising protectionism. Maybe the coronavirus is going to be another factor which prompts politicians in countries to start talking more about localization.
Hmm. Well, Jillian, hang on here for just a second, because let's get a quick call in here. Alicia is calling from Bristol, Virginia. Alicia, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment really follows very closely to what you were just talking about, a pendulum swinging. In most of the conversations that I'm hearing about the economic impact of the coronavirus, I'm hearing talking about the large scale, about how it's affecting the Fed or how it's affecting the global economy, whereas the bottom line is the people on the ground who are being impacted by this, especially people who are most vulnerable, people who have autoimmune issues or other illnesses and are therefore more vulnerable to this particular illness. And there's a huge economic impact on that level. And I would really like to hear that addressed to not just for the callers here, but also to bring that to the attention in general of the policymakers, because we're the ones that are going to suffer.
Yeah, Alicia, let me just jump in here and ask you to clarify a little. When you say a huge economic impact on vulnerable people, specifically, what do you mean?
Well, people who are elderly and are not likely to have the level of disposable income that other parts of other segments of the population. People who have autoimmune illnesses are not likely to have a huge amount of disposable income. And we're the ones that would have to be particularly conscious about taking extra measures, be that buying gloves or staying home or buying particular medications to support well-being. And I also want to mention that many of the people who are autoimmune affected and therefore most vulnerable are also multiply chemically sensitive.
Right.
And a lot of products that are out there which are recommended for antibacterial or intervention in this case would be noxious to those individuals.
Well, Alicia, thank you so much for your call. And go ahead, Jillian.
Yeah. I was going to say, you make a very good point here, which is a crisis like this, or even just a sense of panic, exposes the question about the strength of America's safety net and the degree to which it can or cannot protect people from an event like this. And, you know, one very interesting issue is whether, in addition to the Fed cutting rates, we're going to see governments at all levels, be that municipal, city, state, or federal, actually trying to use fiscal policy, i.e. spending money, to try and support people and bolster the safety net, whether it's through things like waiving the charges to get testing at hospitals for coronavirus, or providing emergency supplies, or doing other actions. So the issue of safety net is going to become increasingly important, as you say, not just for the global economy and the monetary policy issues, but also on the ground.
Well, Gillian Tett is chair of the editorial board and U.S. editor-at-large for the Financial Times, speaking to us from New York. Gillian, thank you so very much for taking us through this walkthrough of the current state of the global economy in light of coronavirus. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.